California Chrome gliding along. He's gone clear by four, and they come to the eight ball, and California Chrome is absolutely sensational. California Chrome will be carrying the hopes of California all the way to the Kentucky Derby.
The thrilling sound of California Chrome running away with the Santa Anita Derby on April 5th, the first step to winning the Triple Crown. More on that later. First, though, a story about a smaller four-legged creature. Yesterday, the gray wolf was afforded endangered species protection in California by a 3-1 vote of the state's Fish and Game Commission. And that's despite the fact that no gray wolves currently live in the state. And despite the fact that the California Department of Fish and Wildlife said it wanted to handle the issue with a pending wolf management plan. Julie Cart is a Pulitzer Prize-winning environmental reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She specializes in public land and endangered species. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Barbara.
Okay, now in February, a gray wolf strayed into Iowa for the first time since 1925 and was promptly shot by a hunter. We don't have any gray wolves living here in California, as I just said, but there is this lone wolf, OR7, that's been visiting from Oregon and has become quite the celebrity here. He's the new hotness. Is he the impetus for Fish and Game passing this rule?
He certainly is. This guy has quite a following, as you say. There's a documentary out about him. He left his pack in Oregon and has gone more than 3,000 miles to find his own way and wandered back and forth between Northern California and Southern Oregon, and then eventually more or less settled in Southern Oregon. So his presence in the state and the likelihood, which we can talk about in a minute, but the likelihood that he now has mated, has a progeny, and these animals will be wandering into California has kind of prompted this decision.
Well, the California Fish and Game Commission met in Ventura back in April, right, to discuss listing gray wolves, and it ended up postponing its decision, as I understand it, until yesterday after getting an earful from a lot of people with strong opinions on this issue. So, and wolves, of course, have been a controversial issue all over the West, the resurgence. Is it California's turn now to have this debate?
There are only strong opinions, I think. Yes, it is, and it's going to be very, very interesting because in the upper Rockies, in the states where wolves are present in fairly large numbers with healthy populations, and in the Great Lakes, they're dealing with an animal that's already established and whatever damage or fears that people have about wolves already in place. So California has a chance to get ahead of the curve on this and prepare for an animal that will no doubt, as wildlife officials here say, within 10 years we'll have functioning wolf packs in California. So it has a chance to make plans, set some rules and guidelines before there's a lot of hysteria. So we'll see.
Although there wasn't hysteria, but at this meeting it was something of a scene, right? People wore wolf costumes. Wasn't there some kind of a cappella howling?
It wasn't howling. I don't want to diminish this woman's vocal capacity, but she was. It was a public hearing where people had 2 minutes to make their case, and there were children who testified, and a woman who looked like a refugee from the 60s, bless her heart, got up and said, I've been inspired to write this. And so no one knew what she was going to present, and she launched into a lovely song about the marvelousness and beauty of wolves.
Oh, that's wonderful. California Fish and Game Commission will never be the same. That is just fantastic. Now, who is against listing the gray wolf as endangered in California?
Well, there's an array, as you might imagine, of folks on either side of the issue, and generally speaking, the people who would not like to see wolves afforded these protections are in the livestock industry, farming to some extent, and hunters who would like to spare the deer and elk for themselves. So they fear that in the case of livestock, that wolves will prey on their animals, and that in the case of wildlife, that the wolves, which prefer elk, that's their number one dining choice, that the elk populations in California, which are highly prized game species, will plummet.
Well, wolves used to range in California. When is the last time we had gray wolves here?
The last documented sighting was in 1924. So the word that biologists use is extirpated. It just means they're not extinct because they exist, certainly in zoos and in academic research settings. But
and OR7.
And OR7. But what happened from the 20s forward is they were gone because they'd been hunted or trapped or poisoned or pretty much run off and they were not welcome, so they didn't come back.
Now, wolves are considered an important part of the ecosystem, right? So why? What's happened to our ecosystem since they disappeared from the scene here in California?
Well, wolves certainly, like all animals, have a role in how a system works and functions. The best way to answer that is to look at Yellowstone National Park, where wolves were reintroduced in 1994. And I can assure you that every bug and plant and bee in that park is studied by somebody. And so when wolves are reintroduced, it put intact the ecosystem. So you had all the top predators, grizzly bears, wolves, mountain lions, et cetera, down to all the critters on the ground. And so it remains the only intact ecosystem in North America, meaning it is as it used to be and without the hand of man. So in that park, for example, willows and streams began to grow because the deer that used to sit there and take all day to nibble on those things now move along because they're worried about wolves, for example, so that they can affect plant communities. There's more for scavenger, both birds and animals like coyotes. There's more stuff left over, scattered around, the odd bone and bit of meat, and they can flourish. I mean, it has an impact. Very much. Now, if you talk to ranchers outside of the park, because these animals move around, they tell you a different story. They would say it's not healthy. But as far as an ecosystem and from pure biology, they definitely have a role to play.
And this is why tempers and opinions range so widely on this. Julie Cart, environmental reporter for the LA Times, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
So does the idea of wolves coming back to the state freak you out or put a smile on your face? Let us know your thoughts at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Unprovoked beatings, gang-like behavior, frequent cover-ups, all allegedly part of daily life at Men's Central Jail downtown, according to testimony in a trial happening this week here in L.A. But it's not prisoners who are on trial, nor was it a prisoner who took the stand to make these allegations. And this is just one of a spate of ongoing legal actions rocking the sheriff's department. Celeste Freeman runs the blog Witness L.A. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Barbara. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So there are just a welter of cases before the court here.
Indeed, there are.
Could you give us the laundry list and then we'll take things one by one? Who's on trial right now and for what?
Well, what we've had is two federal cases in a row that are a result of the 20 indictments that we saw coming from the U.S. Attorney's Office. But this trial and the trial that was a couple of weeks ago specifically had to do with seven members of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department who were accused of obstructing justice, specifically by hiding an inmate who also happened to be a federal informant from his FBI handlers. The defendants say that, number one, they were just following orders. I mean, they are, after all, the six on trial right now are two sergeants, two deputies, two lieutenants who, obviously in a paramilitary organization, were not calling the shots in an operation of this size. The trial earlier was of a single deputy who was accused of the same thing, of hiding this federal informant and obstructing a federal investigation. But the trial points beyond itself to suggest a level of dysfunction in the sheriff's department and in the jails, but not just in the jails themselves, of a sense of arrogance, according to the prosecution, of we do what we want, nobody, including the FBI, gets in our way.
Institutionalized corruption.
Yeah.
Now, you were just telling us about the seven sheriff's deputies that were on trial.
And six right now. We had one trial that finished up a couple of weeks ago that ended up in a hung jury with six and six on each side saying, we cannot possibly decide. And we talked to a number of the jurors. And even the people who voted, the six who voted for acquittal, were pretty sure that something untoward went on. But they weren't so sure that they wanted to slam this deputy, who at the time was 26 years old, James Sexton, and obviously was not running this operation. We listened to now sheriff's candidate still in the runoff as of night before last, Paul Tanaka. We listened to him on the stand, and through emails and documents and some of his testimony, it was very clear that he was calling a lot of shots. And yet, he remains unindicted, although the prosecutor did say in the middle of, you know, one of the moments of cross-examination, Mr. Tanaka, you do realize that you're still the subject of a criminal federal investigation. But he remains unindicted. He's running for sheriff, whereas this deputy, you know, was looking at a federal prison term of 10 to 15 years. And I think the jury had a hard time with that.
Now, why was he tried separately? What happened there?
Well, the reason they severed his trial is he had been cooperating with the feds. And I think this is another thing that the six who wanted to acquit had a problem with. He cooperated with the feds for over a year, was very candid in front of a grand jury, saying, this is what happened, this is what we did, and clearly trying to cooperate. And for his pains, you know, he slept with an indictment and looking at a potential prison sentence. And because of his testimony that both incriminated him and other people, it would have been very, very difficult to have that trial and not have it have an impact on the other defendants. So they severed it.
And with this hung jury, that means he'll be retried?
Well, everybody's getting together to chat about this on June 9th, and we'll find out then. I think that the outcome of this present trial with the six defendants is going to have a great deal to do with whether the feds decide to have another go at Mr. Sexton or say, you know, we gave it our best shot and we're moving along. But without some convictions in this present trial, it's going to be very hard for them to go up the food chain.
Now, you were just talking about institutionalized corruption. Is that the bigger story here, or is it a cadre of institutional corruption?
Well, I think it's institutionalized corruption, again, that we've been focusing with a lot of our press, with the indictments, and with a lot of the public conversation on the problems in the jail. But the thing about this obstruction of justice trial, it points to brutality in the jail. The witness who testified on Tuesday, Gilbert Michel, he was very, very candid, and he talked a great deal about brutality in the jails that he'd been involved with, how he'd been trained to provoke incidents with inmates and then slap them with charges to cover up the brutality that was visited on the inmates when the inmates had to go to the infirmary. He was pointing to vast institutionalized corruption. But above that, you had people looking the other way, declining to look into these incidents. And when this issue with Michelle came up, and he was actually confessing to higher-ups in the sheriff's department, their concern was not whether to pursue these possible issues of corruption, but to shut him up and get him away from the FBI, allegedly.
Now, another case of brutality came to light because of this FBI investigation.
Right.
Also, a man who says he was beaten by deputies at Men's Central Jail while visiting his brother there. And the county settled with Gabriel Carrillo last week for nearly, what, a little over $1 million. But there's a criminal trial on the way.
Right.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, the Carrillo thing, I think a lot of us have that picture of Mr. Carrillo in our head, of who looks like a black and blue balloon, his face. And at the time when this was brought up by the ACLU, it was reported on by the LA Weekly, the sheriff's department said, no, 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 he precipitated this. We had no choice but to control him. And this was not pursued by the department. Once again, we were told that inmates lie, and so do their family members, which, while it may be true, not all of them lie.
And this was no inmate.
No, he was a family member.
Right. It makes you wonder, if you just show up there looking for your car that was stolen, are you going to get...
Well,
I
mean, it points to this sort of, you know, arrogance of we can do what we want to do. And I want to say, I mean, you know, in the course of doing this investigation, I probably talked to, you know, 5 dozen informants that are either currently working in the sheriff's department or recently retired. And the majority of people are just good cops who want to, you know, protect and serve. And that's the heartbreak, is that one of the things that keeps people like me investigating is L.A. County deserves a good sheriff's department, and so do the decent cops.
So what's next? The FBI is still looking into violence and corruption at Men's Central Jail. Should we expect more of these kinds of trials in the future?
Well, you know, we're all waiting to see if they're going to go up the line on the obstruction of justice cases, but their investigations are not limited to the jails. I mean, they're looking into fiscal corruption in other areas of the sheriff's department. So whether they're going to really be able to nail things down is anybody's guess, because it, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office, boy, they don't want to have a trial where they don't win. And so they want all their little duckies in a row. And whether they're going to be able to do it in such a way that we're going to have some really interesting surprises is anybody's guess. But I do know it's going way, way beyond the jail to a depth of fiscal corruption. I mean, you know, dealing with money wrongly. And I think we're going to have some really interesting surprises as the year goes on.
Celeste Freeman, creator and editor of the blog Witness LA, thank you so much for this.
Oh, thanks, Barbara. It was great to be here.
Coming up, comedy, drama, storytelling, uncategorizable happenings. We have a preview of the explosion of creativity that is the Hollywood Fringe Festival. That's just ahead on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. Hollywood is home to movie stars and blockbusters, as we all know, but this month it welcomes back the renegade theater extravaganza known as the Hollywood Fringe Festival. It bills itself an experimental celebration of the emerging art scene and features theater, comedy, and cabaret in the heart of Tinseltown. Often it's a production like you've never even imagined. Here to explain the ins and outs of the festival is theater critic Anthony Burns. He's also host of KCRW's Opening the Curtain. And
Hi.
It's so nice to have you here. Hi.
It's nice to be back.
So this is the 5th Hollywood Fringe Festival, but for people who've never made it to the venues, could you bring us up to date? How'd the whole thing start?
The whole thing started 5 years ago, and it's kind of an outgrowth of the Fringe idea. And the Fringe idea originated in the 1947 in Edinburgh, Scotland, and it was a fringe to the Edinburgh International Festival, which was this, you know, sort of big high production festival. And then around it grew all of these other smaller venues where folks, everyone from, you know, high school students to traveling theater companies to whatever, would throw up these short little two-hour shows. And it's sort of now in Edinburgh, it takes over their entire month of August, and it's literally thousands of shows from 10 o'clock in the morning till midnight. And it's become this big, you know, big colossus. And then there are other fringe festivals all around the world. There's one in New York. Canada has a big sort of traveling fringe circuit across the whole country. So building on that and building on some earlier festivals in LA, there was something called the Edge of the World Fest back in 2000 that sort of tried to do this kind of thing. They thought, hey, what a great way to make a really easy access, really easy way to throw up a show cheaply and quickly in LA. And so now they're in their 5th year.
Right. And does L.A. have its own special flavor?
Well, you know, part of the thing about the Fringe, and this they're very, very proud of, is that it's an open, you know, open, uncurated, uncensored festival. So really, it's open. If you wanted to do a show for $500, you could, right? So it's anyone can come in, anyone can throw it up, which a lot of people have celebrated as being this great, inclusive, wonderful thing, and it's an easy way to do a show. I'm sort of the curmudgeon about it, and, you know, my question is, so there are 200 shows across this, you know, 2.5-3 week period. How do you sort through them? How do you figure out what's good and what's maybe not so good?
Although that's part of the joy of it, right? You never know what you're going to see. And I'm familiar with the Philadelphia Fringe Festival, having come from Philadelphia. And my favorite Fringe experience was seeing an honest-to-God sideshow performer. You know, nails up his nose, lying on a bed of nails, and then you stand on him. And a lot of nails were involved, and then some fire eating. So nails to fire.
Well, in L.A., I think if there's one, you know, the festival hasn't begun yet, so we don't really know what it's going to hold. But there seem to be a lot of zombies. There are, you know, Victorian zombies.
Sure.
Zombies, aliens, and a fair amount of burlesque, I think.
Any vampires? That must...
I think, yeah, of course there are vampires.
Sure.
Yeah.
What am I thinking? And you gave the rating of this, the quality of the theater, about a, would you say, B?
You know, it's so tough, right? Because there are 200 shows. So neither I nor anyone can really kind of wrap their mind around the whole thing. I guess, you know, my question about this is, you know, they're very, very proud about it. It's this gigantic festival. It's the biggest festival west of the Mississippi. Frankly, I wonder, you know, L.A. doesn't really need more theater. It needs more good theater. And so, yeah, there might be some amazing things that you go and stumble in on, but there's also going to be some stuff that's a little dicey. So, you know, you have to have the right spirit, and you have to sort of go in for the whole experience.
Right. And you have to have vitality.
I mean,
it can really take it out of you.
Yeah.
It's really crowded there.
Well, yeah. It's part of the fun of any festival, right? If you go in at 6 o'clock in the afternoon and then at 12 o'clock come out having seen four or five narratives, there's something really wonderful and sort of mind-bending about that.
Right, total immersion.
Yeah, right. If they're good. If they're not so good, it can be a little exhausting.
It has an incredible energy, though. It seems like people just get in there, put up a show, and get out.
Yeah, most Fringe festivals sort of schedule in two-hour blocks. So you sort of come into an empty room, set up your show, perform, and are out in time for the next show to come in. So that adds to a kind of really raw, youthful energy. And that's a lot of the folks who are putting on shows. You know, it's tough to generalize, but these are a lot of folks who are right out of college, right out of grad school, you know, just about to start a theater company. And this is a way for them to, you know, kind of get their feet under them and try something new and try something adventurous, right? And it is, you know, it is so sort of low stress in the terms of it's not a 6-week production that in the best sense, you can completely fail, right? You can throw up something that's radical.
Which is a wonderful thing, especially in theater, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how great shows are made.
I just want more of them.
Well, some hits have come out of the festival, out of the Fringe over the years, though, right?
There have been a couple. I mean, I think the real question about the Fringe is what is it leading up to and where is it going? You know, 2 years ago, it was timed at the same time as the Under the Radar Festival and the TCG Conference. So there was this great sort of critical mass, not just locally, but sort of nationally. The challenge here is, you know, this is operating at the kind of 99-seat and below level. But it doesn't really, you know, outside of the group of people performing in the Fringe, it doesn't really affect the rest of LA's theater calendar. And what would be amazing is either for the festival to sort of grow horizontally and become part of the chain of Fringe festivals across the country or across the world, right? So this became someplace that brought in the best of world small theater and took the best of LA theater and shared it with the world, or if it integrated vertically, right? And if we sort of started to see something maybe akin to, you know, the classic Olympic Arts Festival that we hear so much about from the 80s, where it really took over all of Los Angeles and sort of encompassed so much. So what would be great is to see our presenting organizations partner up with the Hollywood Fringe, and instead of just sort of this, we had this plus something at a higher level plus all these other different sizes.
I hear you calling for organization and more curation and things like that and words that end in T-I-O-N, but that really, is that in the spirit of the Fringe?
Probably not.
Right?
Probably not. But I think,
the free
you know,
for
here's,
all.
Here's.
And uncensored. I mean, there's a lot of very sexually explicit material, we should
there's
say.
There's some very, you know, there's boobies, a burlesque parody of Goonies, which I'm sure everyone's going to run out and see. But, you know.
Hello.
You know, part of the question is, you know, in Los Angeles, the challenge is how do we find critical mass in this city that's so spread out? And
True.
One of the things the Fringe Festival does is it creates that. I guess I'm just one of those people who wants even more of that. I want more connection for the whole city and more connection for LA theater.
Well, can you help us out? What do you have your eye on?
You know, it's so many shows that I think I'm gonna give a shot at the zombie shows. And there's also a Much Ado About Nothing that has Much Ado About Nothing that's retitled Much Ado About Something, and that something is Aliens. And that has me curious.
So you're going with the zeitgeist.
I am.
Well, this is Hollywood, so are actors, producers, and directors looking to be discovered?
You know, I think that's, you know, that's the cliche of L.A. theater is that it's everyone trying to get an agent. And I think one of the great things about The Fringe is that doesn't seem to be either the aesthetic or the goal, that it really seems to be about making art for art. And that's great.
So that's wonderful because not everyone's then looking around to see who's looking around at them.
Exactly.
Anthony Burns hosts KCRW's Opening the Curtain. And it was great to talk with you. I hope I see you at The Fringe.
Excellent.
And the Fringe Festival is in previews now. It opens next Thursday, June 12th, and runs through the 29th. Just ahead, you know the Triple Crown contender as California Chrome, but to his friends and fans at Los Alamitos Racetrack, where he trains, he is their ticket to the big time. We visit the home of Chrome. That's After the News with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin for Madeline Brown. California Chrome runs in the Belmont Stakes this Saturday. He's favored to become the 12th horse in history and the first since 1978 to hold horse racing's Triple Crown. And that would be a big deal for the horse racing business, a big deal for any horse racing fan. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. But first, Press Play producer and horse lover Matt Holzman has the story of what California Chrome means to Los Alamitos Racecourse, that little track where Chrome trains. It's also the story of what Los Alamitos means to California Chrome.
The Santa Anita Handicap, 80,000 people gather, including bearded comedian Joey Brown, and in a neighboring box, Clark Gable and his wife Carol Lombard.
Horse racing in Southern California has always been rather glamorous. And then there's Los Alamitos. Where is Los Alamitos, you ask? Well, it's tucked away in the suburbs east of Long Beach. In 1951, when it first opened, it was mostly dairy land. But now it's just tract houses and a Costco and at least one mega church. At Los Alamitos, there are races weekend nights. And every Saturday morning, you can watch the trainers run their horses. The horses are beautiful, but for the most part, they aren't thoroughbreds. They're quarter horses.
A quarter horse is basically a sprinter.
Ed Burgard has been the track announcer here since 1981.
Their bloodlines are a little bit different. They can't run near as far. They're built more for speed, so you're talking up to a quarter mile.
Hence the name quarter horse. Quarter horses run on a short straightaway, while thoroughbreds often run more than a mile around an oval track. They are the horses most people think about when they think of horse racing. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn if I say that quarter horses and quarter horse tracks are their poor stepchild.
I guess it would be viewed maybe as a stepchild of the thoroughbred tracks, but if you talk to people around the country and talk about quarter horse racing, this is the track that's always been considered number one.
But it seems that Los Alamitos isn't content being the big fish in this small pond anymore.
What happened is that Hollywood Park shut down December 20th, I think it was the last day of racing, and the horses that were stabled at Hollywood Park, a lot of those horses had to relocate.
And Los Alamitos offered to take up the slack. Trainer Carl O'Callaghan was good with the move, but not everyone was.
There was a lot of negativity from a lot of people coming this direction because of A, being a quarter horse track, A, it won't work, it's not going to happen, the surface is going to be this, that, and the other.
Now, at a place where the patrons usually make the wagers, the owners of Los Alamitos were making a pretty big bet. I've heard they've spent $5 or $6 million so far building new stalls, upgrading the look of the place, and turning the short track into a long thoroughbred track. And they're not only going to house and train thoroughbreds here, they'll start running them starting in July. Frankly, the idea of scrappy little Los Alamitos making it in the highbrow thoroughbred game seemed like a long shot. But that was until April 5th.
They come to the eighth pole, and California Chrome is absolutely sensational!
The Santa Anita Derby is a million-dollar race and a major stepping stone to the Kentucky Derby. And it just so happens that the horse that won it, California Chrome, was one of the horses who came to Los Alamitos from Hollywood Park.
Being the home of Chrome, we've really elevated ourselves in the thoroughbred world, for sure.
Melody Neuschell's been working at Los Alamitos for 40 years. But when she tells people where she worked, they just say, where?
And it was still the case up until, you know, a month or so ago. Now people are saying, oh, Los Alamitos, that's where California Chrome lives. And So it's meant a whole lot to us, for sure.
Even the senior mobile home park I live in, people that know nothing about racing, I'll be out walking my dogs, and they say, how's California Chrome doing?
People are nuts about this horse. Melody Neuschell was wearing a California Chrome hat and California Chrome pin when I met her.
Yeah, he's infectious. I'm a chromie, chromatic, whatever. Yeah, I love him. He's chromio.
And she is not alone. Ed Burghardt told me they had a huge crowd to watch the simulcast of Chrome running in the Preakness. But he didn't want to jinx it, so he was sitting downstairs in his office.
When the horse got to the head of the stretch in the Preakness, almost sounded like we were having an earthquake in my office. The tunnel started shaking. I said, where's this noise coming from? And the people here in the... I've never seen a crowd erupt that much.
People here don't just love Chrome because he's a winner. In fact, he's such a favorite, you can't make any money betting on him. People love Chrome because he's a winner with a backstory. He's broken all the rules of a blue blood business based in the bluegrass state. He's California born and bred, and the racing establishment looks down on West Coast horses. And maybe they're right. No Californian has ever won the Triple Crown. And the people who own Chrome picked up his mother for a measly $8,000. Champions can go for millions. On top of all that, he has white ankles. Horse people call that Chrome. And horses with Chrome are supposed to have weak hooves. And then, of course, there's his trainer.
You know, I go through the airport now and I can't believe that people recognize me. I said, wow.
Art Sherman is 77. He's the oldest trainer to ever win the Kentucky Derby. He looks and sounds a little like Joe Pesci, but he's just an everyday guy who's been dwelling in horse racing obscurity for 60 years.
I'm taking pictures with the stewardess. I'm getting autographs. It's been wild and woolly, you know what I mean? It's kind of cool, yeah.
A working-class guy training a working-class horse. It somehow just seems perfect that they both ended up here at Los Alamitos, the working-class track. And I'll give you good odds that on Saturday during the Belmont, everyone here will be betting on California Chrome.
Get up, 2.
42.
24.
42.
It's all right.
Go.
For Press Play, I'm Matt Holzman.
At least I'm still alive here. I hit this double stinking one over there.
So Chrome is favored to win the Belmont Stakes. And now we're going to talk about what that means with Matthew Hegarty. He covers the business of horse racing for the Daily Racing Form, and it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Okay, we just heard how much California Chrome means to Los Alamitos, but he is such a phenomenal story. What does he mean to horse racing generally?
He's a great feel-good story for a game that's really having a rocky go right now.
How is the business of horse racing doing?
It's not doing so well, although it has stabilized over the last couple of years with the onset of the recession in 2008. There was a massive drop in blood stock prices. Most of that was related to the credit crunch. There weren't a whole lot of banks that were willing to extend credit to people to buy horses. And at the same time, you had Handle falling at double-digit rates for a couple of years to the point where Handle has actually dropped about 33% since the high water mark in 2003. But like I said, it has stabilized over the last couple of years, but the game is still struggling as far as being relevant in a really crowded marketplace.
And for us neophytes here in urban Los Angeles, Handle and Bloodstock, what are those?
Oh, Handle is the amount that's wagered on the races, and Bloodstock is basically any horse that is sold.
Yeah, and how important is a Triple Crown winner to the business of horse racing?
It really means the most to Belmont Park. When there is not a Triple Crown on the line, Belmont Park is lucky to get, 50,000 people for the Belmont Stakes. They haven't released any estimates for what they're expecting on Saturday, but the last time a horse was even remotely this popular, Smarty Jones, they did get a record crowd of 120,000, and I would think that that's absolutely possible, considering the reception he's gotten all around the country and even in the New York market, which can be a bit of a cynical market for horse racing.
And you were just talking about the challenges that face horse racing. There are questions and controversies about the treatment of the animals and animal rights groups targeting it. And is it also true that going to the track is too much of an anachronism at this point?
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea of the track being a social anachronism, is probably relevant. There probably is a thread there. But if you do have a lot of good friends that are knowledgeable about horse racing or just like to gamble and be around horses, you can't get a better value for your dollar at some of the nicer racetracks in the country. I think the big problem is that most racetracks, because they've fallen on such tough financial times, have not made the investments that other major sports have. And so you basically have a string of really run-down tracks across the country that aren't fun or exciting places to go, even though you do have those tracks still out there, Santa Anita and Del Mar out in California being two of them, that are fantastic places to visit. The only problem is you only have about a dozen of those places left in the country, with the rest of them being in the need of some serious capital improvements.
What about the issue that racing so often happens during the day? And if you work, you just can't go. Are the racetracks rejiggering the schedule for races?
Yeah, I think that's a big problem for racing. The idea that you would hold the majority of your racing days during the day on a weekday doesn't lend any kind of your marketing efforts any help. You have basically the people that are not working, during the day are basically retirees, and that's why if you go to a racetrack on a weekday, you're going to see an older crowd that doesn't look like it's very enthusiastic about what's going on there. Now, some of them are shifting their schedules to night racing. Churchill Downs has had a lot of success with doing night racing on Friday nights and Saturday nights, getting really big, excitable, enthusiastic young crowds there. And I think you're going to have to see the racing industry adopt some better scheduling if they do want to start marketing pretty heavily to a new generation.
Now, you don't have to go to the racetrack anymore to bet, though. Is that a good or a bad thing for racing? Is that part of the problem?
It's actually been a very good thing for racing. For those devoted fans, especially those devoted fans who might not live near a race course, there aren't an infinite amount of racetracks around the country, but it does have a downside in that if you don't have to go to the track, then you are looking at tracks having, sparse crowds and feeling a bit empty. Most people, especially if you're introducing them to any sport, they want to go someplace where it seems like the sport itself is exciting, and in a lot of racetracks, you just don't have the crowds to support that.
Yeah, it can feel like a wasteland. But you're there in Lexington, the heart of horse racing. How do people there feel about having a California horse in the spotlight now?
I think any racing fan around the country doesn't care where a horse is born. The breeding establishment here probably doesn't have the same view. Their businesses are built on, studs that stand for, anywhere from here in Kentucky, the average sire is in the $25,000 range, but then we do have sires here that stand for, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And exactly, and here's this $8,000 upstart.
Yeah, you don't, if you're a breeder of a lot of high-class stock, you don't want people to have an incentive to say, well, you don't need those $100,000 or $1 million horses. You can get a Kentucky Derby winner, or in this case, perhaps even a Triple Crown winner, with an $8,000 mare that you bred to a $2,500 stallion.
So American, such an American story.
Exactly.
Well, I live near Santa Anita, and I've gone to the track and had a fantastic day there. But Santa Anita is all about the thoroughbreds, of course. And Matt's story about quarter horses got me kind of fired up about that kind of racing. What's it like?
Blink and you might miss it. So they start in the gate. It looks, it really looks like a cavalry charge as they come out, and it's over in a matter of seconds. It's not the type of gambling that I like to do on horse races. When you talk about thoroughbred horse racing, you're talking about a multitude of distances with the horses, with a lot of different styles, and a lot of different things can happen during the running of a longer race. So most people, while they don't disregard or discount quarter horse racing, prefer thoroughbred racing because of so much variability in it, and so many more chances to actually make a pretty good score by doping out the race, using handicapping principles.
Matthew Haggerty, he covers the business of horse racing for the Daily Racing Form. Thank you, and I hope someday to see you at the track.
I hope so too.
Warren Olney is here now. Warren, are you a gambler, or do you just gamble with our hearts?
What a lovely way to put it. And I'll just leave it at that, if you don't mind. Rather than answering yes or no, we're all gamblers in a sense. Every time we step out the door, get out of bed, it seems to me. We're going to be talking today about a very difficult subject. It's the epidemic of violence against women, sexual violence against women, particularly in India and Pakistan. But, of course, it's a worldwide problem. And what to do about it, and will the revelations be helpful and make any difference? So we're also going to be talking about a film called Citizen Coke, which is about the influence of money in politics, and that was dumped, in effect, by the public broadcasting system. We'll find out why.
Oh, I'm looking forward to all of that on To the Point at 1 o'clock. But first, coming up on Press Play, do you use Airbnb or how about Uber? If the answer is yes, then you are part of the sharing economy, and some people call it a revolution. Others take a darker view that it's undermining fair labor practices and contributes to more income inequality. So the case against sharing, the sharing economy, stay with us here on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogavin from Madeline Brand. We live in the age of the sharing economy. You got a house? Why not make money off of it? Airbnb. Got a car? Why not make money off of it? Lyft. What's wrong with leveraging things you already have to make a little dosh on the side? It turns out the sharing economy, though, may be more of a Band-Aid economy, a way to hide the fact that our jobs just aren't covering our basic needs. Susie Cagle is a writer and illustrator who wrote about the sharing economy for the online magazine Medium, and it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much.
So the title of your piece is The Case Against the Sharing Economy, but the sharing economy is the greatest thing ever. I love my Airbnb, and it's been heralded as a revolution. It's supposed to remake the way we work and the way we live, right?
Sure. I mean, and I want to be clear, there are many great things. There's a lot of potential in the sharing economy, but we have to be really careful about not causing the kind of great casualization of work and really kind of redefining what labor is. I think that, we used to have a class of people who had jobs driving cars, and now we're saying driving a car isn't really a job. Anyone can do it. And that's a really slippery slope.
Yeah, journalism isn't really a job. Anyone can do that. You recently attended a conference called Share in San Francisco, all about this. And one of the founders of Airbnb and local politicians and venture capitalists were all in attendance. And your description of this conference, it reminds me of the TV show Silicon Valley, right? If we can make your audio file smaller, we can make cancer smaller. Is that about what the tone was?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything is a revolution. And I think that the sharing economy has largely been heralded as a kind of technology revolution, which I think is really misleading. And it does kind of bring along this kind of perspective of technology, that everything that technology does is going to make our lives better. The sharing economy is really a social and economic revolution, I guess, in many ways. But the technology is just backing it. It's making it possible for these things to happen. But these aren't really technology companies. These are hotel companies. These are car service companies.
Yeah, and we call it sharing, but it's a side hustle. It's supplementary to your day job, and it's not sharing. That's a euphemism.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's a redefinition of freelance labor, because freelance labor has a lot of stigma attached to it. We certainly don't want to be talking about precarious labor, but that's what this all is.
Now, it does have this feeling, though, of being a return to a more humane way of life. And I think that's the appeal, that it takes a village to get you across town kind of thing.
I mean, I think that, again, sharing economy, you know, in those scare quotes, it does have a lot of potential. It can provide opportunities for people who do have, like, you know, the cottage home business where they're just baking pies and selling them to their neighbors. But that's not really what we're talking about. When we are talking about the sharing economy, it's really being defined by these massive companies with millions of venture capital backing and billions in sales, Airbnb, the Lyfts, the Ubers. And they aren't really dealing in sharing. They're not really dealing in an economy of trust and an economy of, you know, rebuilding the village. When people use Uber and Lyft, they are contracting for a service. And I've spoken with many Uber and Lyft drivers who feel that way. They don't feel like they're sharing. They feel like they're wage workers.
And a lot of this work is unregulated, right? What kind of protections do Lyft drivers, for example, have?
Exactly. I mean, I think that the liability question is really significant here. Lyft just recently entered a deal to provide their drivers with better insurance. But there are still a lot of questions about what if something goes wrong? Who's responsible? Is it the person who is driving you because you're just sharing, or is it the company who's backing them, who's really paying them and enabling this whole thing to happen?
Now, getting back to the sharing economy cheerleading conference, there was a labor activist and a researcher there who made a lot of these points when she gave a talk. How did that go over?
Yeah, Vina Dubal, I think that her work is incredibly important in this space. And she told me she was very nervous about presenting there, but I thought it went over quite well. There was a tone at the conference that I think was accepting and maybe even inviting of people like Vina Dubal and other people who had some criticisms of the sharing economy. I do think that there are people who are operating in the space who want to do better. And they want to do better because they really deeply believe in the possibility of this stuff working for us. So I was impressed with how her comments went over.
Oh, I thought she said she thought they'd throw tomatoes at her.
She did think that they would, but they didn't.
Well, here in California, we are seeing government get into the act. The city council in L.A. has been sniffing around Airbnb and looking at how to tax the transactions or ban the whole thing outright. So should we expect more regulations in the future, or is California really taking the lead in embracing the sharing economy and wringing the extortion out of it?
I think in general, California is taking the lead and trying to codify these businesses. I wouldn't say they're trying to mollify these businesses and really give them everything that they want. But I do think in general, we're seeing in California cities that there is a sense of wanting to try to make this work. And I think that there are a few reasons behind that. We are the home of Silicon Valley and technological innovation. And for better or for worse, this is still seen as technological innovation. We are, you know, the Wild West. We do things new and different, and we're proud of that. And we are also a car culture. We really do need more transportation options. I wish that those were public transportation options, but there are some compelling arguments that we need better ways to get around. And I think that Uber and Lyft and other car sharing and car rental kinds of services can use that argument in their favor.
Susie Cagle wrote about the sharing economy for Medium, the online magazine. It was great talking with you. Thank you for this.
Thanks so much.
Jolie Myers is here with the mail, and I feel after that interview that I should pay you by the word.
I was just going to say, we rely on the sharing economy, sharing on social media.
Ah, that tie-in.
And we don't pay for it, so it is actually sharing.
We should pay all of you.
Bam. Are you going to do that? Are you volunteering?
We'll work something out.
So we asked listeners what they thought about Susie's premise, the interview we just did. On Twitter, RB says that people confuse the term sharing with cooperative. Not only do you have ownership when you belong to a co-op, you really are establishing an actual sense of community. So she says it's a term mix-up.
Oh, that's interesting, actually, and that's kind of true. I mean, if you come at it from that history, yes, and I do. I've been in plenty of co-ops, but there you really, I mean, it's a different thing. You give your time, and there's true community. It's not just...
Right. I like my community without having to work in my grocery store.
Really? I like my community with food.
Who doesn't? Okay, so even more sharing. We'll be sharing space with a newly named endangered species in California. That's the gray wolf, which we talked about at the top of the show. Mm. Well, not everybody's happy about the wolf's potential comeback in California. We talked about ranchers in our interview with the LA Times writer. But listener Jeffrey is not one of those naysayers.
It's great that wolves are coming back. They will cost us. But do we have too many wolves or do we have too many people? It's a hard bargain, but it's great they're back.
Also, wolf puppies. Just Google it. They are adorable.
Oh, enough said. Yeah.
So I brought some wolf trivia with me today.
Ooh,
Barbara.
Thank you. I wasn't expecting that. So, you're going above and beyond your duties.
I am. Perhaps I'll share it with you now. The last time we had a wolf in California was 1924.
That was established. Yes, in our interview.
Okay, so maybe I brought some old trivia. But how about this? The highest population of wolves in the U.S. besides Alaska?
Yes.
Minnesota. Huh.
Okay.
Right?
I get it. I can picture that. That's a lovely thought, too. And thank you for that.
All tweetable. Share with us on Twitter.
And that's it for today. If you have any thoughts about the show or more thoughts about wolves, we'd love to hear them. And you can reach us old school at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. We're also on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. And I'll see you tomorrow.